The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting for 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, listeners. Welcome to our Friday morning California time Space Show program. And I am your host, David Livingston. Thank you very much for tuning in. So we're doing a full-length program today, and we do hope that you can call in. Remember, calling us is the preferred way to reach the Space Show and its guest. The toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. No call screeners. Be patient. Wait. I'll bring it up on air as quickly as possible. We also answer the line during the break and put you on hold. So the fact that we're having a break coming up, don't let that deter you from using the preferred way. Once again, 1-866-687-7223. You can also use email, drspace@thespaceshow.com. And you can also post comments on our blog. To do that, open up our website, thespaceshow.com, all the way to the far right is the upcoming show menu. This is the first show listed, so you open that page. It is also our archive and blog page for this program. And then comments are all the way down at the bottom. So you can ask a question, post a comment. As soon as you hit send, I'll get a copy of it and I can bring your comment or question up on air. And once again, you do not, so let me repeat, do not need to be logged in to discuss to post a comment. That is our comment program for our blog, but you can do so as a visitor or a guest. It's very, very easy to do. It's the way I usually post a comment on the blog. So either way is fine, but the telephone is the best. It is a talk show, which means we genuinely like to talk. And again, 1-866-687-7223. Our website, as I said earlier, is thespaceshow.com. So you'll see our full website newsletter. It's over on the far right side, upper part. And that will be updated Sunday afternoon after the Sunday program. But it shows all of what we have planned for the week. And if you scroll down, you'll see all the programs we have planned so far for the end of the year. We have just a few dates left in November, some more left in December. I mean, we're filling up rapidly. And if something really special and hot happens toward the end of the year, we're going to be adding shows. So do check out the website newsletter, and if you have any guest suggestions or comments, you can email me, drspace@thespaceshow.com. Remember, everything we do is archived, and you can listen right off of our website or quickly download a program. We do have a store if you're interested in Space Show logo wear. To get there, click on any of the website pictures of Pepper listening to the Space Show, and Pepper will guide you to our Cafe Press store. There is a menu in the upper left called Listen Live. This tells you how to listen to live programs like the one we're doing right now, archives, which are compressed MP3s on our website, and then podcasts, including Alexa. And many of the podcast players are embedded on our website, but we're in others as well. If you have any podcasting or Alexa questions, feel free to email me again, drspace@thespaceshow.com. To me, always the most important is the fundraising part, because the Space Show requires listener support to keep it going and to have great guests on the show like the one we have this morning. So remember, we are a 501c3 nonprofit with OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. If you're a U.S. federal taxpayer, you get a deduction. If you're a California taxpayer, you also get a deduction. And if you have any questions about taxes or deductions, it's best you check with your own tax advisor. But if you want to run them by me, I'll be happy to give you my thoughts on it. but not knowing anything about your particular situation, I do urge you to ask your tax-related questions to your tax advisor, team, or person that helps you with that. And We have lots of programs planned, and guest suggestions, I've said it already, are always welcome. And maybe 50% of our guests or 60% of our guests come to us because you guys out there and gals suggest the guests to us. So we really appreciate that, and we invite you to keep doing that. In addition to the individual support, you'll see PayPal links on our homepage. And this tells you how to support us electronically, and also it tells you how to send in a check if you don't want to support us electronically. You can make out a check to One Giant Leap Foundation, and it tells you who to mail it to and how to do that. And then I would be remiss if I don't remind you that Amazon has great nonprofit programs. One Giant Leap is registered as a nonprofit with Amazon, so if you buy products through Amazon, they will typically donate to One Giant Leap a percentage of your purchase price. It's a great way to just do your business on Amazon as usual, and then let Amazon support us through your purchases. And many of you do that. There are two great Amazon programs. If you click on that big Amazon link in the middle of our homepage, you will see those two programs. And we thank those of you who do that. And by the way, Amazon is not a sponsor for the Space Show, but again, they offer great nonprofit support programs, and we do appreciate that very, very much. We also have sponsors. So this being a full-length program, I am going to read the short sponsor messages. So they do have their banner ads going across the homepage. You can, as a sponsor, change that banner anytime you want. And for the first segment of the show today, the AIAA is a sponsor. This is American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. It is the world's largest aerospace professional society. They have five main events a year, but they have lots of regional events, luncheons and dinners and other types of programs. And you can sign up for free for the regional lunches and dinners and get on their mailing list. They're in major sections around the country. And in addition, they have a great library going back decades of peer-reviewed and semi-peer-reviewed papers that you can access. If you go to their events, the networking is superb. You do not have to be an engineer to be a member of AIAA. Northrop Grumman is also a sponsor, and they're a leading global security company, and they provide innovative systems, products, and solutions to government and commercial customers on a global basis. And their capabilities range from undersea to outer space and cyberspace. The Space Foundation sponsors us, and they have their incredible symposium, and that is every year in April at Colorado Springs at the Broadmoor Hotel. And if you've never been to one of these events, you're missing out. You need to go to at least one, and then you'll probably be addicted. Networking is like nothing you've ever believed and seen. You might be networking with top people in a foreign government, top military people from this country as well as overseas, top business executives in aerospace. They have an exhibit hall that I promise you, you cannot see and fully explore in one day. It's in multiple buildings, and it's unbelievable. Talk about networking. Just the exhibit hall alone is enough to keep you busy for the entire program, although the programming is really great too. So it is spacesymposium.org or spacefoundation.org as well. Moonward sponsors us, and what if a group of nations was determined to build a town on the moon, and they based their decisions only on technical and economic merit? Moonwards is building a digital vision of that town where you will be able to learn, play, build, and go to events. Visit moonwards.com to download an early draft demo of the town and to fund its development by subscribing. Help us help the world see a bigger future where we can leave our past behind us. And we have other sponsors for the second segment, which we will read when we come back from the break. But our guest today is Jeff Grayson, and it's great to have him back on the show. Jeff is an entrepreneur and innovator with 22 years experience in the commercial space industry. He is the CTO of Electric Sky, developing a long-range wireless power for air and space vehicle propulsion and other purposes, and he is also chairman of Tau Zero Foundation, developing advanced propulsion technology for solar system and interstellar missions. He has been active in the development of commercial space regulation. He was on the Augustine Commission in 2009. You can read his full bio. It is on the website. Rather than continuing to read about Jeff, I would much prefer talking to him, which is always the case. So, Jeff, welcome back to the Space Show. How are you?
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be back. I'm well.
Let's start out. How about you're kind of giving us an assessment of where we are with commercial space, maybe our efforts getting us back to the moon, and then how do you, with all of your new activities, fit into what's happening in the industry today?
Sure. I got into this business like a lot of my colleagues because, frankly, you grew up in the aftermath of Apollo and you thought it was going to keep going, and it didn't happen. And as I sometimes say, if you ask the CEOs of various space companies, you'll find that they all kind of share that story, and at some point they all got really frustrated and decided to do something about it. When I got in, there was reasonable hope that applying commercial practices to rockets and making them reusable, would bring the price down enough that, all the wonderful things we'd like to happen can happen, that people could afford to go back to the moon privately, that governments could afford to go back without breaking their budgets, that we'd be able to start doing industrial development in space. And that could still happen. I want to be clear about that. When I'm going to be talking for most of the rest of the program about things that I'm working on in case it doesn't happen. That doesn't mean that I don't think it can happen. But I want to explain a little bit about where the challenges really are. There's been great success in private companies coming in and doing the kinds of launch capabilities that previously were just the domains of governments. And there's more in the pipeline and more starting every day, and that's all very, very good to see. But what has not happened is the market for launch traffic, commercial launch traffic, has not greatly expanded. And what also hasn't happened, and this is a little bit of a surprise to me, is that the size of the company that it takes to field a launch vehicle hasn't gone down very much. If you looked around at the size of company that was doing launches 20 years ago, you'd see that they were 2,000-4,000 people. Sometimes they were divided up among more than one company to manage their supply chain, but that was kind of the order of magnitude of the company involved. And if you look around at the companies doing, 10-20 metric ton and higher launch vehicles today, they have 3,000-5,000 people in them. A company like that takes about $1 billion a year to keep the doors open, just in salaries and overhead and paying for all the facilities. So if a company like that launches, say, 20 times a year, you can be reasonably assured that if they're making money, the cost of the launch is somewhere north of $50 million. That's just $1 billion divided by 20. What's happened with the advent of reusability and what's happened with the simplifying of the supply chains and all of the other things that have gone on in the last 5-10 years is we're starting to approach that point. We're approaching the point where the cost of the launch itself is almost de minimis. And what really makes the cost of the launch or the price of the launch is just the running cost of the company. And you've also seen that, some high net worth people are subsidizing the industry, because they have things they'd like to see happen in space, and they're putting money in beyond the point that they're necessarily expecting to see a return on investment. And that's helping to bring the price down further. But what hasn't happened again is the launch traffic measured in kilograms per year or number of launches has not gotten all that huge. And, you know, if we want to get down to the point where human spaceflight and industrial activity in space becomes really significant, we get another order of magnitude to knock off the launch price. And there, well, maybe what we will find is that the demand is growing slowly, in which case, if we just stay the course, we'll eventually get there, because the demand may grow slowly, but it will grow, and as it grows, the price will come down. But maybe we're going to find that some further step change is required to get us down there, and part of what I do, and this is more my electric sky side of my hat, is think about, are there technological changes we could make that would address that problem and bring the cost of down even at the present launch traffic? And then, as a way of introduction, we'll come back to this later in the program, the same kind of challenge is true for things like Mars human spaceflight or for robotic missions to the outer solar system and beyond. We're kind of technologically stagnant there. There, as far as propulsion is concerned, we're kind of just still using chemical rockets and solar electric. And those have gone about as far as they're going to take us. If we want to be able to do more aggressive missions, have them happen faster, certainly for human spaceflight, they almost have to happen faster. But even for robotic spaceflight, you know, waiting 20 years for your mission data to come back really restricts the number of missions you can do. At the Tau Zero Foundation, that's farther out, so that's a non-for-profit enterprise. We're working on some advanced propulsion technologies to try to make our capabilities for doing outer solar system and interstellar missions, you know, a little less science fictional, a little more science fact.
Jeff, so we have a private sector that seems to be getting more and more active and maybe slowly evolving. And then we have, of course, what the government is doing. And we have this government program, Artemis, to go back to the moon. So I'm curious how you see what the government is doing to get us back to the moon, for example, Artemis, or however we want to describe it, in a relationship with what you're talking about, where we need to keep getting prices down lower, we need to see the launch traffic pick up, meaning more opportunities in space, obviously, for more entrepreneurs. Are we fighting against each other between privates and government, and the vision that you're talking about? Is the government program, is NASA enabling, or is it just neutral and it has no effect on what you're talking about?
Complex question.
Yes.
Okay, NASA has obviously funded a huge amount of the research on which the whole industrial base rests. You can't go far before you are referencing, you know, a NASA paper or technical report. On the other hand, a large number of those papers and technical reports kind of date back to 1975 and before. There are also, NASA's not a monolith. You know, there are pockets of funding inside NASA that occasionally fund advanced propulsion work that I think do a lot of good. Some of the work in, it's great to see that there's a resurgence, even a small scale of interest in nuclear thermal propulsion, for example. The NASA Institute for Advanced Concepts, or I kind of have the acronym wrong, but NIAC, has funded a very large chunk of the work that underpins a lot of what we're looking at the Tau Zero Foundation. So it's certainly not true to say that NASA is not relevant or not a useful resource. But when you talk about the large kind of flagship programs, that's just not the part of the industry I spend my time thinking about. You know, there's a huge lost opportunity, because the lion's share of what you do on a moon mission or a Mars mission, the lion's share of the mass launched is propellant. and that propellant, if launched as part of the stream of traffic for the entire commercial launch industry, would be significant. You know, it would materially add to the launch traffic if the launch for that were purchased on the open market. And so there's always a certain amount of what could be different, lost opportunity, and that you cannot help but look at that and say, if that were being purchased privately, not only would the mission be cheaper for the government and for the taxpayer, but the effect on the U.S. launch industry would be very beneficial. But, you know, that's counterfactual. That's not what they're doing now. That's not what they were doing last week. That's not what they were doing 10 years ago. And it's probably not what they're going to be doing 5 years from now. So other than a certain amount of, gosh, it's an opportunity lost, what they're doing as far as the flagship missions is sort of its own thing. It doesn't hurt the industry that they're doing it. It doesn't help the industry as much as they could, but they're doing it for reasons of their own, for reasons of government policy that, you know, are not germane to the question of supporting an active commercial launch sector.
The effort to get back to the moon, for example, in Artemis, you're not particularly focused on that. Are you optimistic that it will happen? And if it happens, does it help the industry? Are you there?
I'm there. Sorry. I'm thinking about my answer. I haven't dropped off. Okay. Today, 15 years ago, launch to orbit was not really a priced commodity. You know, if you wanted to launch something, it was a negotiation every time. There was no catalog price. Changing that has had a very beneficial effect on the development of the satellite industry. It's a big factor in why so many satellite companies are now being privately funded, is that you can go to the catalog, price your launches, put that in your business plan, and your investors know what it's going to cost to launch. It is possible that an offshoot of a return to the moon program with commercial participation might be that transportation to cislunar space or transportation to the lunar surface will become a priced service. You know, and it will be something that you can just write a check for. Even if it's a big check, just being able to write a check and get there enables you to start thinking about what kind of businesses could you do that would be enabled by that transportation. If that happens, I think that'll be beneficial. How beneficial will depend on how low is the price. As to whether it will happen or not, hey, you want odds, go to Vegas. I got other things to do with my life than place bets on the outcome of government programs.
The private sector, are you satisfied with the pace it's moving at, or do you think there are ways that it could move even faster?
I'm a little concerned that this wave is stalling. And it really relates to what I talked about in the introduction. There's a curve that I sometimes show when I'm giving talks that doesn't work on the phone. That's the elasticity of demand traffic curve for the launch industry, that basically points out in a graph what we can say in words, which is that at very high launch prices, decreasing the price of launch actually reduces the revenue of the industry, because the price is so high, there aren't a lot of customers waiting to jump into the market when the price comes down a little bit. And then at very low prices, new users become enabled to enter the market that use much higher volumes of traffic, and the industry starts looking like other transportation industries where lower prices make your revenue go up. In between, you have this sort of valley of death, and I call the bottom of that the revenue minimizing price. You know, just the shape of that graph means there must exist a price at which the revenue of the industry is as low as it can go. nobody knows exactly where that price is, but my own estimate is that that is somewhere around $1,000, $1,500 per kilogram to orbit. We're getting awfully close to that price right now. Three things could happen, right? We could stall there, and the industry will be stuck for a while at a revenue minimizing price, or that price might be low enough for new applications to emerge, and in which case we'll continue to push down in price, and the traffic will start to grow, and the revenue will go up. Or one or more companies will eventually fall out of the market, and will go back to the previous state where the price of launch was higher because it supports, you have to be able to support at least two companies for there to be a competitive price. And then the fourth thing is what I spend my time working on, which is, or we could find technological change that enables us to push down to lower prices without waiting for a fundamental transformation in the nature of the market. And that's what I'm working on in my day job, which I'll be glad to talk about if you'd like.
Yes, absolutely. So describe a typical day in your day job. I mean, how do you work on tech changes for something that is probable but not here yet, and maybe not even a clear idea of when it will be here, or maybe you do have a clearer idea of the timeline?
I think it took 3 years, but I think we've come up with a clearer idea. So Electric Sky is really an answer to this question of, suppose that the high traffic model of spaceflight can't happen until the price comes down a long way, hundreds of dollars per kilogram or less. And being mindful of this problem of right now the traffic isn't huge. There's two ways out of that. One of them is, could you think of a technology for doing launch that you could do with a much smaller company? And the other one is, can you think of a technology for doing launch where the company would be supported by other markets? Obviously if you have a company that's selling products to more than just space launch customers, then that running cost of the company is divided by more users, and you can offer a lower cost product. And that was a tough problem. And when I was posed that by Robert Millman, who had come out of Blue Origin, and he's the CEO of Electric Sky, I was not sure that there was a way to do it. And it led to a very long technology search through, is there anything we can think of that would have those properties? We think we've got something, and that is long-range, high-power, low-cost power beaming, or wireless power transmission, if you prefer. In principle, what that does is it lets you take the majority of the energy storage off of a vehicle. So, for example, if you were talking about an electric airplane, electric airplanes mostly are made up of batteries. If you could get the power from the ground, you could leave the batteries on the ground. Then the vehicle would be a great deal lighter, a great deal less expensive. The economics of operation would be very favorable. Electric aircraft are already cheaper than petroleum-powered aircraft to operate, but they have very limited range. If you get the power from the ground, you could overcome that problem. When it comes to space launch, we're all used to these physically very large, imposing machines that, make loud noises and have big tails of fire coming out the bottom. When you look under the hood, what is going on there? What is that? Well, there's a large amount of kinetic energy that it takes to put a vehicle and a payload into orbit. That if you carry that kinetic energy in the form of fuel and oxidizer, it's heavy and bulky. Then you have to not only lift the payload, you have to lift all of that propellant, and the propellant that 1 second earlier, you have to lift all the propellant that it takes to carry the payload plus a second's worth of propellant, and so on for 2 seconds, and so on for 3 seconds. And now that makes the vehicle physically large to hold all that propellant and heavy. And that means you need big, powerful rocket engines to lift it off the pad, and that means that you need, you know, big companies that are dealing with massive, large objects to put those vehicles together, and big launch complexes that have big distances to get away from the big flamey bits. So there's sort of a snowballing effect that when you get right down to it and you think about, okay, you know, what's a satellite? You know, even a big satellite is, you know, 10,000 pounds, something like that. You know, it's the size of a small truck. These giant multi-story devices are not carrying the payload. They're carrying all the energy that it takes to turn that payload into something sitting in orbit. In principle, if you could figure out a way to get that energy off the vehicle, you'd be able to lift the thing with something the size of a light airplane. Which, you know, lots of light airplanes are made by much smaller companies than launch vehicles. Now, of course, the small miracle has to occur. You have to have a way of getting the energy up to the vehicle. That's not easy. So we have quite a bit of work to do. But we have found some relatively new physics, new like 20 years ago new, that people don't seem to have understood, noticed the implications of, that allows you to transmit beams of electromagnetic energy that instead of being concentrated and focused all the way along the beam like a laser, are spread out and diffuse and very low intensity along most of the length of the beam and are only high intensity at the transmitter and at the receiver. And that solves a number of problems. That lets us spread out the transmitting elements over more area, lets us go to much lower frequencies, radio frequencies instead of optical frequencies, and avoids the problem of unintentional radiation exposure to things like birds that might be flying through the beam, or other aircraft that might be flying through the beam, because the intensity of the beam far away from the transmitter and the receiver is actually quite low. And that all looks very good on paper, that all looks very good in the computer, and we're about to go into the laboratory and make sure that we haven't made a fundamental mistake and prove these things on the bench.
What is the range of transmitting that beam?
Depends on there's almost no question you're going to ask me though, if the answer isn't going to be it depends, unfortunately, because that's a little bit like asking what's the range of an electromagnetic beam. It depends on the frequency and the size of the aperture of the transmitter and what you're going through and a variety of things like that. But at the frequency that we're looking at right now, for feasible kinds of transmitter array sizes that use a lot of dirt, but dirt's cheap, but the elements are spread out, so they're not very expensive. Looking like hundreds of kilometers, we've done some analysis looking at powering satellites on orbit from the ground. That looks interesting. There might be customers for that. But frankly, most of our, you know, we kind of always have a launch vehicle case going because that's what started the company. But the nearest term things we'll probably be doing are things like powering UAVs, you know, over hundreds of meters, because that's a much easier thing to do and it's a much cheaper thing to do and it's a good place to start. And then we can earn revenue from powering UAVs or urban mobility vehicles or light aircraft and use that revenue to scale up the scale until we're ready to do a launch vehicle.
So your goal is to do launch vehicles?
That's where we're going. You know, if you can get a range of about 100, 125 kilometers, that's enough range to do the job that the first stage of a launch vehicle does. And, you know, the first stage is about 90% of the weight and mass and cost well, 80% of the cost of doing a vehicle, doing a low orbital vehicle. So if we could just do the, just get rid of the first stage with the beam, we would be very, very happy. You know, it's even better than reusing the first stage is what if you don't have to have one.
Where do you get the power for your beam?
From the electric grid. Although you do need for the large power beams, you need a battery bank or other local accumulator because you don't draw from the grid at the same rate that you dump it into the launch vehicle. You draw from the grid, you know, over the course of a day or two, charging your accumulator, and then you dump the accumulator into the beam transmitter.
Okay, and so when you do this in the lab, where do you go from the lab to actually a demo flight? And if all went well, when would something like that happen?
First product will probably be a system for keeping small UAVs in the air over hundreds of meters, or assisting in the takeoff and landing of UAVs. They use most of their power when they're taking off and landing, so you could extend the batteries quite a bit if you just powered them that during that phase of flight. And those are sort of rooftop scale systems that you know, we would sell to UAV operators. That's probably the first product, and we're probably about two-ish years out on that.
I have a question for you from a listener, and this is Josh, who is in Denver. And he says, Jeff, if I can jump to advanced propulsion for a minute, other than the work that you're doing, since you brought it up earlier, there seems to always be a lot of talk about it, but there doesn't seem to be anything that comes online to demo or test. Is that because there isn't enough funding in the industry, or it's too hard, or there seems to be some kind of a bias against testing something that might be really advanced, even nuclear?
Oh, great question. I might be on the microphone for a while answering that question.
You've got, let's see what we have. You've got about 8 minutes before the break, or 10 minutes
okay.
before the break, and then you got another 30 minutes. So we're
okay.
40 minutes.
If you're talking about private funding, you know, before there can be private funding for advanced propulsion, one must have a product or service that one's going to sell that is enabled by that private funding. You know, today there are zero commercial flights to Mars, Neptune, or Alpha Centauri. That makes commercial funding of those ventures a very challenging proposition, which is why Tau Zero is a not-for-profit philanthropic foundation. If you're talking about public funding, there is some, and I want to be clear about that. You know, NIAC, which is a NASA sponsored advanced propulsion, and there's some other pockets of funding within NASA, is almost all the funding that there has been for advanced propulsion. So it's absolutely not fair to say that NASA doesn't do this. But it is fair to say somehow it never seems to hit prime time. And the reason for that is, it's not unique to propulsion. This problem exists a lot of places inside the space technology business, in that R&D funding kind of comes from one pot of money, and sometimes you can get it and sometimes you can't. Missions come from another pot of funding, you know, and they're sold for reasons that have nothing to do with the neat technology that you're going to put in the mission. You know, manned missions are sold to achieve various national objectives, of which pushing technology is really not in the top 10. And, you know, science missions are sold, because, the science user community, has certain scientific objectives that they prioritize getting the answers to. And look, I got better propulsion is not even on the list, let alone in the top 10. Furthermore, there is an active bias against advanced propulsion technology in the science community. because it takes, you know, there's so many science missions that people would like to fly. It's a career-long bet for a researcher or principal investigator to get a mission sold. You know, they could spend 10 years selling the mission and 10 years getting the mission built and 20 years flying the mission. That's a lifetime. The last thing you want to do is just go through it, get halfway through that process, and then find out your advanced technology didn't work. So if there's any way to do a science mission without introducing new technology, they would much rather do it that way. So there's no publicly funded user community asking for advanced technology. Now, you might think there should be, because there are a lot of advanced science missions we'd like to do that we don't do. Because we don't have the technology to do them affordably or at all in some cases. And similarly, you know, we've been talking about going to Mars forever. Everybody knows better propulsion technology would be either extremely enhancing or even enabling of being able to do that mission. And yet we never do it. Well, but that's true, but we don't go to Mars the old-fashioned way either. You know, so there's a lot of talk about it. There's a lot of jobs in studying how we're going to go to Mars someday, but there's not actually a government user community that wakes up tomorrow and says, God, if I could just get to Mars faster and cheaper, I would do more of it. So there's not a user pull. Very much what the Tau Zero Foundation is trying to do as a not-for-profit is we're trying to find philanthropic sources of funding to fill in some of these gaps. And take some advanced propulsion concepts that we have seen in the literature or that we've found researchers who are pursuing and saying, you know, if we could just get these folks a couple of graduate students, but not just for 1 year, you know, kind of on an ongoing basis, they might be able to pursue their research and publish enough papers that, for example, science users would find it, would start to become aware of the fact there might be missions they would now be able to do. And, you know, if a scientist, for example, who wants to do a Neptune orbiter, which is a mission that a lot of scientists who work in planetary scientists would love to do, we've only seen Neptune once, you know, from Voyager, and it was a flyby, not an orbiter. But, you know, that mission is completely out of reach today for cost reasons, largely because of propulsion. And it would also be a very lengthy mission. You know, you'd probably take 10 years getting to Neptune. You know, if you could do Neptune in a year and do it with a spacecraft that was small enough and light enough that it could be launched, you know, in a conventional class of mission instead of needing something in the ultra-heavy class, we probably would have flown that mission by now, and some scientists would be publishing the papers right as we speak. So that's how we're trying at the Non-For-Profit Foundation to see if we can address that problem, is to kind of keep a nucleus of advanced propulsion work that's going, keep a community of researchers going and talking and publishing so that the users become aware that there are options other than one more solid rocket on top of one more Atlas.
I have another question for you, okay?
Sure.
So this is Lee, L-E-E, and Lee says that he's in Atlanta, and he says, I am aware that at Space Access and also ISDC, there was lots of advanced propulsion commentary and presentations, lots on beam energy, and in fact you presented at Space Access as well as ISDC, but antimatter propulsion showed up at both events with two different speakers. I'm assuming they represent two different companies. Is nuclear electric, nuclear thermal, are they the only close-in advanced propulsion possible economically for our use, maybe? Or is there something like antimatter propulsion that's just around the corner or something else? Do we have a choice?
There, in my opinion, there are actually lots of good alternatives. And I could talk about as many of them as time permits. The challenge with nuclear fission, well, okay, backing up one. We're like 8 minutes from break here or less.
Well, I can push it. So
okay.
Let's say we'll take the break in about 10 minutes. Okay.
Okay. What makes advanced propulsion both interesting and challenging is that to achieve a more capable mission, you need both more energy. You know, more higher velocity means more energy. But you also need higher what's called specific power. You know, the rate at which that energy is converted into propulsion has to go up. The problem with nuclear electric is that the power is very low. So the power to mass ratio is very low. So you can trade a lot of propellant mass with chemicals for a lot of nuclear reactor and radiator mass. And you can greatly reduce the weight of propellant that you use, but it isn't jaw-droppingly improving the total mass of your mission or the total time of your mission because the accelerations are low. Nuclear thermal, very few people appreciate how far advanced that once was. You know, had Apollo 20 flown, it probably would have carried a nuclear thermal reactor. You know, that rocket was built. It's sitting out as a gate guard somewhere. You know, those engines were tested full duration and considered to be mission qualified in the late 1960s. So today the challenge would be that because of the changes in environmental regulation, testing those engines would be a very expensive proposition. People are thinking about how to do that again, and I applaud that there are companies actually and NASA centers actually investing in nuclear thermal again. It's a long overdue technology that I would love to see. But it does have this problem or challenge that it's not as much better, if I can say that, than as chemical as you'd like. When you get the nuclear thermal has good power to weight, but the specific impulse is not that awesome. It's about twice as good as chemical. Now, twice as good is twice as good. You know, it's you'd love to have it. The question is, given the significant investment it would take to recreate that capability today, is anybody ever going to fund that development to full scale? Or could you just take that money and buy more rockets and put bigger propellant tanks on your vehicle and achieve the same result? We do have a discussion going at Tau Zero with one of the nuclear thermal propulsion companies exploring some ideas about how to get higher ISP out of nuclear thermal, which I think would, you know, if we could get another factor or two out of it, and I think that might be possible. That might make it enough better to make the return on investment story look a lot more attractive to a government agency. But that's an example of where, you know, some research that is inexpensive can change people's ideas about where it would make sense to invest the larger amounts of money it takes to bring these systems to practice. So it's a highly leveraged point. A little, if you woke up tomorrow and people accepted that, oh yeah, if we invested, we could get nuclear thermal rockets with high thrust to weight and, you know, 1800 seconds of ISP, we probably have invested the money by now if people thought that was a doable thing. So the research to find out if it's a doable thing is a highly leveraged activity.
Okay. Is there anything as close in and as feasible as nuclear thermal? Is there some other type of advanced propulsion?
There's at least, I won't try to say how many there are. There are several. One that I'm personally very excited about is what's called in the literature the plasma magnet. I've given some talks on this. It's some work that was done at the University of Washington in the mid-2000s, funded by NIAC. and people don't appreciate how far it got. You know, what it is a solar wind sail of relatively speaking, high thrust of weight. You know, the accelerations you can get are on the order of 0.05 meter per second squared, which might not sound like a lot, but in interplanetary terms, that's a lot. The solar wind goes very fast. The solar wind is leaving the sun, depending on the direction and the time of the year it is, at between 400 and 800 kilometers per second. Whereas normal interplanetary departure speeds are measured in single-digit kilometers per second. So it's fast, it's free, it's already there, and there's ways to collect it and use it for propulsion. And that's just, I mean, we could start building that. I don't know what we would do tomorrow except to start designing and building it, because it's been tested in vacuum chambers on the ground. It works. There's always some questions about testing space plasma stuff on the ground because there's, you know, issues of will it scale up? I think it will, but the only way to prove it is to test it in space.
But go ahead.
I'd love to do that.
But this is not going to be used for a launch vehicle, correct?
So No. If I had a better idea than beamed power for Earth to orbit, I'd be doing that. Beam power is my best shot for Earth to orbit. But when it comes to advanced propulsion, in some ways Heinlein said correctly that low Earth orbit is halfway to anywhere, but you do have to worry about both halves.
Okay. That cracked me up.
If I still got time, the antimatter thing is really interesting. The two companies you might be hearing about are HBAR, which is working on basically anti-proton-based systems, and Positron Dynamics, which, as the name would suggest, is working on positron systems. Positron is a very near-term technology at their lowest levels of performance. The lowest levels of performance are you get radioisotopes that decay to positrons, you use the positrons to do things. That'll work. The performance, although interesting for some applications, is not jaw-droppingly revolutionary. They have a technology path that is currently being funded by NIAC to doing a very interesting cycle that I probably can't explain, but they have a website that's essentially a positron antimatter breeder that uses positron catalyzed fusion as the propulsion mechanism. There's some significant technology unknowns in that approach. That's what makes it great work to do, because at the research level, what you're looking for is ideas of maybe this works, maybe it doesn't, but if we found out it would change your mind about what you could do, let's go find out. So I'm thrilled that NIAC is funding exploring that work to find out whether that has the scaling potential that it would be nice to see. The challenge with any protons is they're hard to make. The guy behind HBAR, Jerry Jackson, is a particle accelerator guru, and he is convinced that they can be made much more easily than we used to think, even if still with great difficulty. And because even in a good scenario, they'd still be hard to make, you want to develop propulsion systems that use them very sparingly. So most serious ideas for positron or antiproton-based systems are based around two challenges. You got to store the antimatter in some compact, lightweight form. And you have to use it to catalyze something else. So instead of direct conversion of the antimatter, you use a little bit of antimatter to release a lot of energy some other way. The system that Jerry Jackson at HBAR has been talking about is, he calls it the antimatter fission fragment sail. And what you do is you use each individual antiproton strikes something like a uranium atom, it breaks the uranium atom open, and the particles of uranium fragments that go spitting out are your reaction mass. If that were funded, I could imagine seeing that field in 20-ish years. But, you know, that's 20 years plus the time it takes to get it funded, which is unbounded.
Jerry's planning to be on the show October 20th, so that should be
great.
An interesting show.
He can talk
show.
About it better than I can.
we are going to go to our break. So, listeners, we do answer the phone for those of you that can call us, 1-866-687-7223. Email can continue to come in, of course, drspace, drspace, at thespaceshow.com. And give us about 3 minutes, and Jeff and I will be back. Don't go anywhere.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of The Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
Welcome back, everybody, to Part 2. We do have our Part 2 sponsors that I would like to read their messages and thank. So the Space Development Network is talking about the lunar greenhouse. When permanent bases are established off Earth growing food, there will be an important part of making the bases sustainable. But could we grow all the food necessary to support and nutritional needs to the crew? A lot of good work has already been done on the issue, in particular at the University of Arizona. Work has been done to develop the prototype lunar greenhouse. The Space Development Network has developed a web page that describes how food could be grown inside an initial habitat to provide all of the food needed by an initial crew. Also on the website are videos of experts speaking on the topic. Check out developspace.info/greenhouse, and I'll repeat it, developspace.info/greenhouse. And Celestis sponsors us, and remember, they are still the only proven space burial company around. And they have suborbital flights out of New Mexico and orbital flights for your loved one out of Florida and Vandenberg and soon other places as well. They hope to have their moon trip soon and other deep space and maybe Mars missions in the future. You can also add your DNA to a little bit of the ashes of your loved one, or if you don't do cremation, DNA for your loved one, and make the ride symbolically with your loved one. So you can get much more information on Celestis at celestis.com. And remember, I am their customer, so I'm very biased toward them. They're a great company, and I've done 3 flights with them with my dogs and my mom. And as I keep saying, it's hard to applaud a funeral company, but wow, they're really a great business. And it's a very good service and closure service. as well. In addition, we have the National Space Society as a sponsor, and they do ISDC. It's going to be at the end of May in 2020 in Frisco, Texas. And they also do other kinds of meetings. They have a Space Settlement Summit. They issue white papers and do other work of great interest to Space Show listeners. So you can go to space.nss.org for more information on that. And then there is the Integrated Space Plan. So do remember that they just finished their Kickstarter, and they're going to be funding and developing their new Integrated Space Plan, which will include the latest work by SpaceX and Blue Origin. And it will be available soon. And this is the flow chart, as you remember, that depicts the different paths for becoming spacefaring with new technology. You can go to their website, thespaceplan.com, and you'll be able to buy their new plan and get all the information you want. And remember, the virtual space plan, the one on their website, you can expand the cells into lots more information. So again, if you want more information about that, thespaceplan.com. And there were four people that took the Space Show offer to support the Space Plan. So in the near future, we will start having these four guests on the Space Show, and I will make sure to identify them as guests that are coming our way via having supported the Space Plan. And Jeff Grayson is back with us. Jeff, if we look at getting off the launch pad, it's hard to visualize you, because we're so used to seeing these big rockets standing up vertically and the engines fire and all the flames and noise and everything goes off, and it takes a hell of a lot of effort to lift that thing off the pad and to get it going. And so you're going to scrap all of that and just send an electric beam to a receptor on the rocket, and the beam propels it. Is that what happens?
All right, except no more rockets. But it is hard to get your head around. It might be helpful to kind of go back and talk about some of the earlier iterations of this concept, because beaming propulsion is not a new idea. What we think is new is we think that we have a way of doing it at a cost that the market will bear. The idea actually goes all the way back to Tsiolkovsky. He was a busy guy. But it wasn't until the laser was invented that people started really being able to think about it practically, because now you could see that there was the potential for beams that have such high power that you could do something with them. In very rough terms, a small launch vehicle, the amount of power it's using, the amount of power it would be using if it wasn't carrying this giant load of propellant on board, is on the rough order of 100 megawatts. You know, depending on the size of the vehicle, it could be 1,000 megawatts, but 100 megawatts is a nice round number to hold in your head. So if you can't, you know, you got to be talking about power in that range, which is a lot. The first experiments in power beaming, beam power propulsion I can think of, used lasers. There's two different ways of doing it. One of them is, and again, I want to emphasize, this is all prior art. This is not what we're doing at Electric Sky. There was a group under Lake Mirabeau that was using high-intensity pulse lasers, and the lasers would shine up to essentially a mirror on the bottom of the ship, and the laser pulse would heat the air underneath the vehicle so rapidly that it would ionize, absorb the laser energy, and essentially explode. It was a detonation of the air. And then the next laser pulse would come along and do the same thing, and the next laser pulse would come along and do the same thing. And they tested that over ranges of, I forget the exact number, but hundreds of feet, based on a laser that they had access to that was built by the Department of Defense. Idea worked. There again, you're using the air as the reaction mass, so you don't have to carry tanks of it with you, and the first stage does its job essentially all inside the atmosphere, or even though it, the outer atmosphere for the latter part of the first stage. But the first stage's job is essentially the air is available for use as a reaction mass. It's not being used as a chemical reactant. It's not being used as an oxidizer the way you would in a jet engine. You're just pushing on it. There was some work that Jordan Kerr, who we sadly lost not too long ago, was working on that was laser-powered rockets where you'd carry a tank of propellant on board, use the laser to heat it, and squirt it out the back. That was something you used to call a poor man's nuclear rocket. The laser provided the heat, and the reaction mass was carried on board the vehicle. Some work's been done on microwave thermal, where it's the same basic principle. You have a tank of propellant on board, you make it hot, but you use millimeter wave in that case. What's interesting about the lower frequencies, when you get below, you know, down into the microwave region and below, we have electronics that are fast enough that you can receive the incoming energy as electricity rather than as heat. What's interesting about that is that electricity is a very useful form of energy. You can use it to do other things without generating a lot of waste heat in the process. We'll give a poster example. You know, if you have a combustion engine, you're very happy if 25 or 30% of the energy that you are consuming in that engine comes out as shaft power. You know, a jet engine on an aircraft is in the 25 to 30% range of the energy you burned came out as mechanical work. Where'd the rest go? Well, the rest came in out in the exhaust. Electric motors, you know, are 93, 94, 95% efficient. The electricity that comes in, almost all of it comes out as work. So there's real advantages in trying to do a small, lightweight thing in not having to have a big heat dump that takes all the waste heat away. And although exactly what this vehicle would look like, even we don't know yet, you know, where we have concept sketches, we don't show them because they all look very different from each other, and the important thing is to make the beam work. The reason why we don't know what a vehicle is going to look like yet is not that we don't have options, that we have too many options. Once you have a vehicle that has lots of electricity without carrying lots of mass, there's lots of ways to use that to push on the atmosphere. And the question is, which one will turn out to be best, and we don't know that yet. So it is hard to picture. I appreciate that it's hard to picture. But, you know, let me take it to what is probably the absurd extreme. I do not think we will do this, but it's easy to understand. Propellers work supersonically. They're just not quite as efficient as they are subsonically. You could beam electricity to a vehicle, and it could turn an electric motor, and it could turn a propeller, and you could push on the air. You know, I think there's better ways to do it than that, but that there's one example of how could you possibly accelerate a vehicle through the air if it had electricity available.
And so you would accelerate the vehicle to the point where the second stage, which would be more conventional, would kick in. Yes. and take over. So you're not talking about beaming to the second stage.
We have some concepts for that, but they're much less mature. As I said, I'd be perfectly happy to start with if we only knocked one zero off the price of the launch. You know, just got rid of the first stage and still had to carry a little tiny rocket to do the second stage's job. But if you look at something like a Falcon 9, you know, the second stage is this little dot on top, that's about as long as the vehicle is wide. When you look at something like a Falcon 9 or an Atlas, what you're looking at is a first stage. The second stage on an Atlas is inside the fairing. It doesn't even show outside the vehicle.
Listeners, you can still give us a call. There is time, 1-866-687-7223 for those of you accessing your telephones today. And email remains drspace@thespaceshow.com. Carolyn is in Seattle with a question for you and said, maybe it's too early to know this, but what kind of environmental concerns or EIR information would be needed for a beam propulsion launch vehicle?
Good question. It's one that we're studying. We don't have a definitive answer to it. It's a little bit, the area is not full of good precedents to draw on. So anything you say about the regulatory picture is a little speculative. What I can say is, I want to be careful with the numbers because I'll get them wrong. But, no activity that human beings do is free of consequence. It's always a case of picking lesser versus greater. If you are doing a conventional launch vehicle, you're launching, million pound kinds of propellant tanks and combusting those gases to result in the launch of thousands of pounds of payload. If you were doing this in an electric fashion, instead of doing it that way, you would be consuming on the order of, let's say it's 100 megawatts for 6 minutes. That's 10,000 kilowatt hours of electricity to get that job done. And the resulting emissions in the from the vehicle are basically nothing. The emissions all happen at the power plant where you made the electricity in the first place. Power plants on the ground, even if they burn fossil fuels, are very much more efficient than power plants in the sky because you can afford to put energy recovery cycles that use more of the waste heat that otherwise would be dumped out in the exhaust. And you can carry things like scrubbers that take more of the combustion products out of the exhaust because you don't have to worry about the weight. And, of course, on the ground we have things like solar farms and wind farms and hydroelectric dams and, whatever, nuclear power plants, all of which are too heavy to carry on airborne vehicles. So I think the environmental story is quite favorable, but nothing is free of impact. We will have to study the effects of the electromagnetic radiation, the radio energy. I already mentioned that one of the advantages we have over past beaming schemes is because it's this very special kind of beam that spreads out and comes back together. Most of the distance of the beam, it's a very spread out beam, so you would hardly know it was there if you weren't using special instruments. So we're very encouraged about that. But I don't want to say there's nothing to worry about. Everything has an impact, and the question is, we have to study what it's going to be.
Little bit of an offbeat part of the question in this beam propulsion is Henry in Memphis. And he says, I'm sure everybody listening to the show is aware of the idea of a Green New Deal, but they talk about getting rid of fossil fuel airplanes and everybody laughs. But what I'm hearing is that maybe someday you could fly transcontinental with an electric transportation commercial jet similar to the big Boeing and Airbus jets of today. Do you think doing that electrically is even feasible 20 years from now?
I totally do, and it's not off the wall at all. In fact, that is very much part of our business plan. In fact, it gets better because the economics of electric vehicles are so much more favorable than the economics of combustion vehicles. Part of it's because, as I mentioned, the onboard efficiency is very much higher. So even if you lose some in the beam, as far as the vehicle itself is concerned, the efficiency is very good. Secondly, the electricity can be used in a variety of ways. There's a lot of different aircraft configurations that are being studied right now where you actually burn the fuel to make the electricity to distribute it around the vehicle so that you can power lots of little engines that are just in the right place. It gives you various kinds of aerodynamic and efficiency advantages to do that. It'd be a lot easier if you could start with the electricity. electric aircraft right now are being developed and sold for things like pilot training. And the reason for that is that operating a piston engine aircraft is expensive. Okay, why is that? Well, part of it's the cost of the avgas, but a large part of it is the cost of maintaining the engine. Aircraft power plants are relatively complex devices that have relatively short life, and they have to be gone over by expensive mechanics on a fairly frequent basis. Electric motors mostly just run. So people have estimated that the cost of operating an electric aircraft is on the order of like a tenth as much per flight hour as the cost of operating a piston engine aircraft. Again, the problem is they currently haven't got a lot of range. If you had a couple of power beams, you know, at your source airport, at your receiver airport, and maybe at a couple points along the way, you could fly from point A to point B all electric with the batteries we've got now. And then just to sweeten the pot, you know, everybody always wants to know about flying high speed. You know, why can't we fly faster? Well, the reason you can't fly faster is when you go supersonic, the liftover drag gets cut in about half. So for the same technology, try as you might, when you go supersonic, it costs twice as much in energy. Well, electricity costs half as much as fuel. And the efficiency of converting it to work is three times better. So that's a factor of six. We can afford a factor of two. So not only can you envision doing much less expensive and flight where the emissions are based on what the emissions are from your ground power system, not from your airborne power system, but you can imagine doing high-speed flight at prices that would be competitive with subsonic aviation today. So I think the technology has tremendous potential. I mean, it's a little bit like 100 years ago when we invented this thing called electricity. You know, before we had electricity, things that used power always had to be right next to things that generated power. You know, water wheels ground grain. You had to bring the grain to the edge of the water so you could put it in the water in the mill that was powered by the water wheel. You know, steam engines were right next to machine shops, and they had belts that ran from the steam engine to the lathes and the drill bits. When we got electricity, suddenly things that used power, like lights in your house, didn't all have to be right next to the things that made power, like the dam in Niagara Falls. If we pull this off, we have done the same thing for mobile users. Now you can have airborne vehicles that don't have to carry their source of power generation with them. The power generation can be on the ground in whatever fashion is convenient and deemed environmentally friendly by the trends and regulations of the day.
So would the airplane have to be in range of a beam to make a transatlantic flight, for example, or it would have batteries that stored the power?
For subsonic flight, I don't envision that for safety reasons. I don't think I'll live to see the airplane that doesn't have some batteries on it. Today, fuel-powered airplanes are required to carry half an hour's surplus fuel just in case there's some problem when they arrive at their destination. And I can't imagine an electric aircraft that wouldn't carry at least half an hour's worth of battery reserve. But, you know, half an hour is something you can do right now. 4 hours is something you can't do right now. So if you could power it along the way, every so often you'd go over a power station and recharge your batteries. I call it in-flight refueling for electric aircraft. And you'd be able to do your destination that way. For high speed, for over water flight, obviously it's inconvenient to put power stations all the way from here to Australia. And that's why I think it's actually interesting to look at doing that as a high speed flight. You know, we talked earlier about how a small launch vehicle might use 10,000 kilowatt hours of electricity. Okay, at rough retail prices, 10,000 kilowatt hours of electricity is $1,000 of electricity. You know, that's not a lot of quote-unquote fuel cost for going to space. And if you can go to space, you can go halfway to space, which is Australia. So they, you could potentially build up kinetic energy in your vehicle by passing over several transmitters at your launch country and then coast to your destination country, bleeding off the kinetic energy that you have already stored up in the vehicle.
Ben in Kansas City has a two-part question for you. He says, today, and I don't know for how much longer in the future, most electricity comes from fossil fuels. Some comes from nuclear and some comes from hydroelectric. But if you're using fossil fuels to generate the electricity needed for propulsion or for aircraft, it would seem to me that you're not saving much, which is sort of the case for electric cars. Also, which would be harder, the beamed power launch vehicle or the electric airplane that had some decent range to it?
The beamed power, the second one's easier. The electric airplane's easier than the launch vehicle. That's why we expect to start with UAVs, go to electric airplanes, and then move on to launch vehicles. Because the power level is higher and the range is longer. For the beam to power a launch vehicle than to power an airplane. The first question is more complicated than it looks. I was surprised when I got into this field to discover that electricity is cheaper than fuel. Like, how can that be? Right? You burn fuel to make electricity. How can electricity be cheaper than fuel? But it is. You know, per kilowatt hour or megajoule or however you prefer to measure it, it costs twice as much for fuel than electricity. Part of that is because a given vehicle that burns a given kind of fuel that goes out into the marketplace only burns one kind of fuel. The marketplace knows that, right? So there's a price premium to deliver a particular grade of fuel to all the distribution points, because they know, you know, if natural gas turns out to be cheaper next year than diesel fuel, that doesn't mean everybody turns in their diesel fueled trucks and starts burning natural gas. You know, there's a large investment in plant and equipment. You know, airplanes are going to keep burning jet fuel next year. Even if the price of jet fuel goes up, they're going to keep burning jet fuel because they're not going to convert the fleet, even though you certainly could, in principle, burn something like liquefied natural gas. Secondly, for launch vehicles in particular, but even for airplanes, something people don't think about is the mass of that fuel contributes to the mass of the plane. The mass of the plane has to be lifted by the wings. That causes the drag. That causes the energy making the airplane move through the sky. For a long-range airplane, half the weight of the airplane is in the fuel. If you could take the fuel off, the airplane would weigh half as much. It would burn half as much energy for getting the same job done, for carrying the same passengers over the same range. Thirdly, as I mentioned, when you get into below the surface, there are differences between ground power plants and mobile power plants. You know, let me take a good example. When we burn natural gas to make electricity, essentially what's inside that plant is a jet engine. General Electric sells you a turbine, which is closely derived from the turbines they used to make for jet engine aircraft. So you'd think at first glance, okay, it must be about the same thing, right? Well, but it's not. You get about 25-30% efficiency out of a jet engine for an aircraft. You get about 50% efficiency out of a power plant making electricity. Why? Because it makes sense to put more machinery to recover waste heat and turn it into electricity for the power plant on the ground. There's, in the case of natural gas plants, there's a steam cycle that takes the hot jet engine exhaust after it's made its electricity and boils steam and turns more turbines and makes more electricity, so you get a lot more electricity out of each unit of fuel that you burned on the ground than you would in the sky. You couldn't do that in an airplane because you'd have to carry all that machinery. It wouldn't make sense to do. So for all those reasons, there actually is a net savings of energy, especially for launch vehicles, but even for aircraft. Now, you know, no free lunch. Power transmission is not perfectly effective. There'll be losses. When all is said and done, I think what you're going to find is, in total raw energy terms, I'll be happy if it's a wash, because our energy will be twice, will be half the price, and the emissions will all be controlled to the standards you control ground emissions, not airborne emissions. And then, of course, there are things that we do for electricity on the ground other than burn fossil fuels, and those are expanding over time as their price comes down.
Weather, storms, things of that matter, would that affect the power beaming or the usage of electricity or the power needed?
The frequencies that we're currently looking at using are pretty much unaffected by weather, unless you're talking about rainstorms so severe that you probably won't want to be flying in them anyway.
Okay.
It's a question of wavelength. You want to, at the lower frequency, well, I mean, when you're listening to if anybody still listens to a radio, you know, when you're listening to a radio and it's raining, you can still hear the radio.
Right.
It's because the radio waves are very big compared to the raindrops. So they more or less shine right through the rain, just the way that the light shines right through the atoms in a makeup of glass window.
Jeff, we're pretty close to the end of our 90-minute program. What have we missed or omitted, or what did you want to talk about that we haven't had an opportunity to talk about yet?
Mostly I would just say if anybody out there is themselves in a position to take on a philanthropic cause or might know somebody who is, the Tau Zero Foundation is a nonprofit organization. And, you know, a little bit helps. We're looking for larger philanthropic donors to fund some of this research. But in the meantime, just going to conferences and talking to people about what we're doing is part of the process. And that itself has to be paid for. And we pay for it the way that you pay for the space show, you know, through donors and members and people buying stuff on philanthropic links on Amazon. So, you know, you tell two friends and they'll tell two friends. And the next thing you know, we'll be at Jupiter and here.
What is a Tau Zero website?
Tau Zero, TAUZERO, dot Aero, AERO.
Dot Aero. And I'm assuming that PayPal and donation things are there plainly on the website for those who want to support it.
Yes, sir.
And your progress, you're totally private at Electric Sky, correct? And there's no investment opportunities at this time, is that correct?
If you're qualified to invest in non-publicly held companies, I'm not that hard to reach.
Okay. Well, we'll leave it at that. Are you going to be up at the SSI gig in Seattle in a couple of weeks?
No, I've done so many trips the last half of this year I had to triage, but I will miss it, and I wish you all well.
Well, I'm in the same boat you are, so I, too,
okay.
will miss it. It's been great talking to you again and having you back on the space show, and I look forward to following what you're doing, and we'll probably have more questions in the future, and hopefully you can come back and keep educating us on many of these things.
I enjoyed it. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Listeners, that's it for today, and Sunday is our next program. Everybody have a great weekend. Do keep looking up. Goodbye from Jeff, David, and the space show.